Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Ed Gillen, along with Kevin Howard. I represent Bruce Banther with regards to this appeal of his third conviction for murder in the first degree and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. For 10 years and two previous trials, the state of Delaware claimed that Bruce Banther, along with John Schmitz, acted in a substantial planning and agreement to lure a man by the name of Dennis Ravers to a property outside of Farmington in Kent County, lured him there, ambushed him, killed him with an axe, and disposed of the body. Throughout those 10 years and two trials, and into the third trial, Mr. Banther has proclaimed his innocence. Mr. Schmitz, in 1999, pled guilty pursuant to a plea agreement with the state of Delaware, in which he pled guilty to murder in the second degree, received 20 years, of which he's done 11 years, and continues to be incarcerated. At the first trial of Mr. Banther, he was acquitted of the charge of conspiracy in the first degree. And that formed the substantial basis of the second appeal in this case, in which this court held that pursuant to the provisions of collateral estoppel as codified in 11 Delaware Code Section 208, the state was not allowed in future trials to proceed on conspiracy theories against Mr. Banther. Prior to trial number three, the state in argument on motions told the trial court, "We still believe that Mr. Banther and Mr. Schmitz entered into an agreement to do this, to commit this murder," indicated trial counsel for the state they could not take a position on who had in fact killed Mr. Ravers as the principal. That position, as we went into the third trial, was consistent with where the state had been for Banther 1 and Banther 2. Prior to this trial, the trial judge asked the question then to the state, considering this Supreme Court's decision, how was the defendant's right not to be convicted based upon an agreement protected, when it became absolutely clear that the state was going to present the same evidence that it presented in Banther 1 and Banther 2 into Banther 3?
The phrase you just used is an interesting one. Convicted on the basis of an agreement, or words to that effect, is there a distinction between being charged with conspiring to commit the crime and simply producing facts that may be consistent with an agreement, but when the indictment accuses him of doing it, in murdering somebody intentionally?
I'm not sure that I grasped
I didn't articulate it very well. But is there a distinction between making a conspiracy or an agreement a fact that has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict, and simply having facts introduced during the course of a trial where what the state has to prove is intentionally causing the death of another person beyond a reasonable doubt, where reliance on an actual agreement with someone else is really arguably immaterial?
Yes, I would agree with that proposition, but under the particular fact, in a vacuum. But
well, in other words, was the jury instructed that in order to convict Mr. Banther, they could find that it's based on him conspiring with someone else to murder the victim?
Essentially, yes. We believe that the instructions as given, and that's part of the argument that we submitted in both the brief and hope to submit today to the court, that instruction actually allowed the jury to find Mr. Banther guilty under a conspiracy, under an agreement type theory.
Not because conspiracy or agreement were charged, but because of the way in which they were instructed, allowed them to find that they could conclude he intentionally murdered someone as a result of agreeing with someone else to do so?
Because the instruction as given in this case did not comply with, and that's really the third or fourth argument we have on argument one in this case, but the instruction as given by the trial court did not comply with what this court indicated that the trial court had to focus on. At page 12 of the court's decision, this court gave orders to the trial court to focus the jury on whether the facts supported beyond a reasonable doubt that Banther had independently engaged in substantial planning of Raver's murder and Banther had unilaterally agreed to carry out that plan. And you could read the instructions as given throughout. The word unilateral was never used. Absolutely. And the two words that the court italicized, this court italicized in its opinion, were independently and unilaterally. And yet the word unilaterally is never used in the court's instruction. The problem with, one of the problems with the trial court, as I said, letting the state proceed on the same theory, the same exact evidence that it used to show conspiracy agreement in the past. The state argued that this same evidence that it used to argue that now could be used to show that Banther acted by himself. Yet, one of the first things that the defense did in this case was ask for a curative instruction. A curative instruction obviously is given when evidence can be used for one or more purposes and there's a limitation. And if it was ever a limitation, it should have been given in this case. And from the outset, we asked for a curative instruction to be given. And repeatedly throughout the trial, all the way through jury instructions, asked for a curative. Now, the state in its brief in dealing with the Golden Rule violation extols the virtues of curative instructions. And this court has many, many times talked about how curative instructions may solve problems.
So help me out here. Despite the fact it's in the brief, tell me what limiting instruction you asked for and why, and tell us where the trial judge erred by not giving that instruction or by giving the instruction that he did give.
Well, the last part of that, the judge never gave any instruction. So there's no argument that the judge's instruction.
Well, at some time he obviously instructed the jury on what they had to find beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict the defendant.
But the judge never instructed the jury on limitations of what they could use all this evidence as we went through week after week after week of the trial in this case. The actual curative instruction was requested first on January 10th of 2008, found on page C8 of the transcript, where we asked the court to give the instruction that this evidence cannot be used to show any sort of conspiracy or agreement between Mr. Schmitz and Mr. Banther.
Yeah. And he wasn't charged with having conspired.
But that evidence.
No, I know.
Well, but that evidence was used before to show that Mr. Banther conspired, agreed, or acted as an accomplice along with Mr. Schmitz to do that. The state in its answering brief doesn't address this argument at all. It doesn't argue that no curative should have been given, and certainly doesn't argue that it was harmless error, because it couldn't be a harmless error under this case. Because this was really the thrust of what this case was about, as the state basically threw what they could up against the wall, hoping that the jury would find something about it. The state never argued. When we got to closing arguments, and the state had to look those jurors in the eye, the state never argued, hey, there was a Travis-like unilateral accomplice liability reason to convict Mr. Banther. The state never argued that because there was no basis. And that actually is the second reason why the court, respectfully, we submit erred in dealing with this issue. We asked for a judgment of acquittal at the close of the state's case. There was absolutely zero on only the accomplice liability theory. There was absolutely zero evidence. The state was never able to articulate to any evidence, nor was the trial court in denying the motion for judgment of acquittal. The closest the state came in its brief on appeal in response to the argument about the motion for judgment of acquittal on accomplice liability should have been given, argued that when Mr. Banther and Mr. Schmitz placed the body of Mr. Ravers at a different location from where he was killed in a burn barrel, that in fact that was somehow a Travis unilateral spontaneous action between Banther and Schmitz, which was sufficient. That's the only thing that anybody from the state.
I thought the Superior Court opinion also said Schmitz testified that the victim was breathing still.
Absolutely. That's exactly what the state's argument on appeal is based on.
Right.
Now, I do want to address that because I think that's rather important. Number one, the state had Dr. John Butts come testify. Dr. John Butts is the head of the medical examiner's office from the state of North Carolina. He testified as the only expert witness in this case, provided obviously a report, pretrial, and discovery. He testified, which can be found at page 122 of the appendix, the cause of death were any of the four axe wounds where Mr. Ravers was struck in the head at the scene. He testified that breathing would cease shortly thereafter, that the person would die shortly thereafter. There is absolutely zero evidence in the record whatsoever to indicate that this body being placed in a burn barrel afterwards caused, or as the state argued in its brief, hastened the death. There's nothing to go ahead and support that. That would be completely contrary to the evidence. But if we suspend disbelief for a second, and we say, okay, let's say that Mr. Schmitz now, who has expanded his story, okay, as the state admitted and is contained in the record at page 149 here of the appendix, Mr. Schmitz gave a taped statement in preparation for the trial, turned over to the defense. He did not say that at this burn barrel scene that Mr. Ravers was still breathing. He was led into this at the trial for the first time by the prosecution, apparently in an effort to go ahead and support this new theory. But let's say for the sake of argument that in fact, is somehow the cause of death, even though Mr. Schmitz repeatedly said, no, he was dead beforehand. I never did anything to contribute to the death of Mr. Ravers, found on pages 293 and 297 and 215 of the appendix. If the court should somehow find that sufficient evidence to allow the jury to consider an accomplice liability theory, then we have an agreement. Then we have a clear, express conspiracy agreement. Because what this was, according to Mr. Schmitz, if you take this testimony, Banther has struck the blows with the axe at the scene. Okay. Mr. Schmitz having nothing to do with it. But now he asks, John, help me with this. They work together to pick up the body, take it from where the person is laying on the ground, carry him over to a truck, put a bag around his head working together, pick him up, place him into a truck. Then Mr. Banther getting into that truck to drive it away, Mr. Schmitz goes into the roadway to direct the truck, making a three-point turn as to how to get out. Mr. Schmitz gets into another vehicle as they agree together. They're talking the whole time, according to Mr. Schmitz, as to what to do. Go to a different scene. Pull up to the different scene. Get there. Take the person out. Open the barrel. Pour the gasoline on the barrel. Take the person out of the truck. This is a long agreement, conspiracy that they're doing here together. If this court should somehow accept that there was sufficient evidence to allow this to go on to that being the cause of death, and that was sufficient to allow that theory to go to the jury as accomplice liability, that's exactly what this court in Banther 2 said they couldn't do. There was an agreement there. There was a conspiracy. Mr. Schmitz says, boy, I was afraid that I would be the next person if I didn't go ahead and help Mr. Banther out in doing this. And they went through all these actions. But quite frankly, Your Honor, there's insufficient evidence to go ahead and allow that to be submitted to the jury and should not have occurred in this case. And again,
let's go back to where we were when I asked my earlier question. What evidence is there in the record to say that Banther was an accomplice to Schmitz?
None. And that was my last point on that.
That was the instruction to the jury. You can convict Banther for being Schmitz's accomplice.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And so what was the evidence to support that?
None. And that's why they should not have given, the court should not have given that instruction. There was zero, and that was the basis of our motion for judgment of acquittal and our objection to any instruction on accomplice liability being given. There was absolutely none. No evidence of that whatsoever of Banther acting as an accomplice to Schmitz. And that, of course, is that's the point, Your Honor.
So if we
go ahead. But wasn't there evidence that Banther himself did the killing?
If you believe, yes, if you believe Schmitz's testimony directly, that Banther unilaterally did it without any involvement of John Schmitz, yes.
So you're saying it should have gone to the jury on intentional murder with regard to Banther only?
Yes, principal liability was no, as Your Honor, I think, articulated very well, there was no evidence of accomplice liability in this case. Yeah, and the only thing that the state even argues about, and I know you're going to get a chance very shortly to hear from Mr. Williams on this, the only thing the state has ever argued about is the burn barrel theory, which I hopefully have put to rest here, but we'll have this opportunity. I do certainly want to go ahead and talk just for a minute at least about the way that the state actually reduced this trial to a game as opposed to a search for justice and violated due process. My opening comments were not simply meant as introductory, that the state for 10 years and two trials alleged a conspiracy that Banther was part of and substantial planning, and then literally in the middle of a trial put a man on the stand who now still sits in jail and has sat in jail for 11 years, and the state looked those jurors in the eyes and stood before the court as officers of the court and argued that that man was telling the God's honest truth when he stood up there and said, I didn't do it at all. I'm innocent. That man, and only that man, meaning Bruce Banther, committed the crime. If ever standards of decency and due process are offended, they should be. Not only about what has happened, obviously, to Mr. Banther being convicted by the state changing theory, but this man sitting in jail today, for the 11th year that he's sitting in jail, when the state takes a position before a court of law that he had nothing to do with this, that he was completely innocent.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. May it please the court, I'll attempt to respond to the first two arguments that have been addressed today in oral argument, but if the court has any questions about the other two arguments that are raised in the briefing, I'll certainly attempt to answer those as well. The thrust of the argument, is, as the state understands it, is that allowing the Superior Court at the state's request to give an accomplice instruction was improper in this case. The accomplice instruction that was given was a correct statement of the law, and it was appropriate given the evidence in the case. Admittedly, as the case played out, it was approximately a three-week trial. This was the third trial of Mr. Banther. Most of the evidence, and that was addressed certainly in the closing by the state, concerned the testimony of John Schmitz, the co-defendant. John Schmitz had not testified at the first two trials, but Schmitz was one of the three people who was present at the scene when the homicide occurred, and he was, at that point in time, the only available witness. Schmitz testified as to what occurred. Schmitz said that Mr. Banther had struck Dennis Ravers four times with an axe, and that after the fourth blow, Mr. Banther asked Mr. Schmitz to assist him in trying to put a large green bag, a plastic kind of trash bag, over Mr. Ravers and to assist Mr. Banther in loading Mr. Ravers into the back of the Dodge Dakota pickup truck that belonged to John Schmitz. That is the focus of where the accomplice liability is in this case on the basis of the evidence. The testimony of Mr. Schmitz at the trial was that while he was helping Mr. Banther load Mr. Ravers into the back of the pickup truck, that Mr. Ravers was still breathing. He described it as a rasping, labored type of breathing. Mr. Ravers is loaded into the back of Mr. Schmitz's pickup truck. The two individuals Mr. Banther and Mr. Schmitz then drive in separate vehicles to another location that's nearby. This is an area that's outside of Harrington and Farmington, Delaware. It's a very rural area. They drive a short distance to a second location. Mr. Ravers is removed from the back of the pickup truck, and he's dumped headfirst into a large 55-gallon metal barrel that Mr. Schmitz refers to as the burn barrel. Mr. Schmitz, again, in his trial testimony, says that when the body of Mr. Ravers is being taken out of the truck and placed into this burn barrel, that, again, Mr. Ravers is still breathing. When he's placed into the burn barrel, Mr. Banther, the defendant, pours an accelerant, I think it's gasoline, onto a fire, attempts to ignite a fire. Mr. Banther is banging on the sides of the barrel with a claw hammer to open up some air spaces to accelerate the fire. Mr. Schmitz testifies that because Banther is not having much success in making holes in the burn barrel, that he takes it upon himself to take the claw hammer away from Mr. Banther and to make the holes himself. Now, the testimony of the autopsy physician, Dr. John Butts, who did an autopsy on the at least decomposed body or partially decomposed body of Mr. Ravers when it was retrieved approximately a month later in North Carolina, was that it was possible that while the cause of death was the blows to the head, that an individual could be breathing for a short time thereafter. He didn't think it was certainly any long extended period, but that was the sum total of the expert medical evidence here, was that it was possible, in his expert medical opinion, that Mr. Ravers could still be breathing.
But what is the evidence that supports the state's theory that Banther was Smith's accomplice? Wouldn't Smith have to be involved in causing the death?
Well, I think Schmitz is involved in causing the death by doing two things. One, putting him in this bag and taking him from one location to another and then putting him into the burn barrel. So, and that's what Schmitz says.
I thought
says.
The cause of death were the injuries to the head or from the axe.
Well, I think that is the cause of death. The question is whether or not he hastened his death. And I think Dr. Butts, I don't know if he was asked this question, but I think his opinion would probably be that, you know, but for anything intervening,
so
he eventually would have
Banther
died.
Banther didn't kill him with the axe. Schmitz hastened his death by what you're attributing to Schmitz. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I think you've got to view it all in conjunction because that's what happened. I think certainly the ball starts rolling down the hill because Mr. Banther attacks Mr. Ravers with the axe. Strikes him four times, and then while Mr. Ravers is still alive, probably barely, they both work together to put him in this burn barrel and attempt to burn the body.
Right. Well, just tell me in one sentence, this is why Banther is Mr. Smith's accomplice. What's the how would you, or stated differently, Mr. Banther is Mr. Smith's accomplice because.
Because he assists in placing Mr. Ravers into the truck, transporting him to a second location, and then placing Mr. Ravers in the burn barrel where the body is then attempted to be burned. I think that's the sum total, and that's really all there is as to accomplice liability.
What's the sum total of the testimony in the case directed to cause of death?
Well, it's the testimony of Dr. Butts, he's the only medical expert, and I think it starts around A-124 or so. He's asked, and you said the cause of death would essentially be damage to the brain, eventually causing loss of stopping of the breathing. And then Dr. Butts says the cause of death is the head injury. The mechanism by which it leads to death is ultimately inducing or the failure of the central respiratory control and cessation of breathing. The heart stops. And then he's asked, can you say anything about how long someone who suffered such injuries meaning the blows to the head, would continue to breathe? Would it be immediate? Would it be a little longer than that? It would be my opinion, Dr. Butt says, that follow, this is the bottom of page A124, that following the infliction of all the injuries I saw, that cessation of breathing would have either occurred or would, cessation of breathing either had occurred or would have occurred shortly thereafter. I don't think there is a long period of time that he could have continued to breathe. This is top of page 125 now. But it's possible he would have continued to breathe for a while. Question, you can't say how long. Answer, no, sir. Well, not a great deal of time, in my opinion.
Well, this isn't a wrongful death case. This is about who intentionally caused the death of another person. So the cause of death were the blows with the axe. What's the issue about how long he may have breathed after he was struck with the axe four times? How does that relate to cause of death?
Well, I think it relates in terms of
time
whether
of death, but cause certainly, of death?
Certainly whether or not there is any evidentiary basis for an accomplice liability instruction, and that's really what the argument is. There was more than sufficient evidence for the jury, if the jury believed Mr. Schmitz, to convict Mr. Banther as the person who caused the death. The question is whether or not the jury instruction as given was appropriate given the state of the evidence.
Well, but I thought the state's theory at this trial was that Mr. Banther killed Mr. Ravers with the axe. Is that the theory of the trial that's in this appeal?
Well, I think that's certainly the focus of what the closing argument is all about. There's one very brief statement at the beginning of the state's closing where there's a mention of what accomplice liability is, but it's not really tied to any specific evidence. And the majority of the state's closing thereafter concerns the testimony of Mr. Schmitz and how it should be believed by the jury because it's tied in with the other physical evidence that the state had introduced at the trial.
Why did the state ask for an accomplice liability charge if the theory of the case was that Banther directly caused his death with four blows by an axe?
Well, I think when it was requested at the beginning, and a lot of this happened before trial, there were defense motions in limine before trial as to limit the scope of what could or couldn't be presented. Mr. Schmitz does not testify until day 13 of the trial. The trial ends, I believe, the evidence ends the next day, and then the closing arguments are on the 15th day of the trial. So until Mr. Schmitz, who has not testified at either of the two proceedings, actually gets on the stand and testifies under oath before the jury, the state doesn't know exactly what evidence it's going to have. And I think that was their problem at that point, was that until Schmitz got on the stand and testified, it was difficult to say what he was going to do.
More simple. And when you decide to instruct the jury, you have to be able to point to some evidence in the record that supports it. And it seems to me the exchange would have gone something like this. The state says we want an accomplice liability charge, and the defense responds, well, it's not supported by the evidence. And the state says, well, there's a suggestion that Mr. Ravers was breathing subsequent to the four blows with the axe. And the response from the defense is, well, yes, but the only uncontradicted evidence is that it were the blows from the axe that were the cause of death. So we don't have any evidence that Banther was anyone's accomplice. If the most the record would say is that Smith's was Banther's accomplice. So I go back to my question, how do we find record evidence to support an instruction to the jury that Banther was Smith's accomplice? When the state's theory and Smith's testimony is, Smith's didn't kill him, Banther did.
Well, I think the only thing is what I've said, is that the two of them do work together after the axe blows have been inflicted.
I know. Working together, though, we've got to connect to the cause of death. As the Chief Justice said, if we've got a person who's going to die and did die from the only testimony in the record from the axe wounds, then it's the person who dealt the axe blows that caused the death. somehow you have to distance yourself from the axe blows as the cause of death to have Banther become someone's accomplice, don't you?
Well, I think either you do that or you have to have the other scenario of hastening the death. And if there's additional action that hastens the death, I think that pulls both individuals in.
Record support for hastening the death?
Well, I don't know if it does. I think it's a fair inference to be drawn, though, that if you put somebody in a big plastic bag, stick them in a burn barrel and ignite the burn barrel, if they're still breathing at that time, you're hastening their death by doing that. I think that's a reasonable inference.
Who hastened the death?
I think both Banther and Mr. Schmitz did that because they were acting in concert at least at that point in time. And I think that was the evidentiary basis. And that's really all there is in the record. The accomplice liability instruction probably becomes more apropos in terms of the attack on Mr. Schmitz's credibility as to he's asked by the defense counsel, well, why did you plead guilty? And his response is, well, I thought I was responsible. And then I think there's an objection or some discussion with a court about that. And the court says, well, you know, that was his testimony that he thought Mr. Ravers was still breathing, and that's why he felt responsible, and that's why he ends up pleading guilty to second-degree murder, that he thinks he's somehow involved in the homicide. So in terms of evaluating the credibility of Mr. Schmitz, the instruction's probably appropriate for that basis, but I think it also has at least an alternative basis here if the jury is somehow going to reject Schmitz's testimony in whole or in part.
Does the record reflect that it was Mr. Ravers' idea to testify? That Mr. Ravers contacted the state?
Mr. Schmitz contacted the state?
I think he did. I think he wrote at least one letter, and he may have written more than one letter at some point. I thought there was communications years ago, and then there was more recent communication.
Yeah, there's one communication the record reflects where Schmitz wrote the state and said, I read you can no longer present a conspiracy theory in your case. You do have one viable alternative. I'm available to discuss this matter with you.
Yes, I think that's the more recent one where he suddenly comes forward at this point and says, okay, you know, I'll testify.
Did he suddenly get a reduction in his sentence too?
No, he didn't get a reduction in his sentence. The state's position was that they would take no position if he filed a motion for reduction of sentence. And I believe a motion has since been filed. I don't think it's been acted on by the trial court or anything. And that was the only concession the state was giving, is that they would take no position on the sentencing. At the time of the first trial, Mr. Schmitz's case had not yet been concluded. He didn't plead guilty to the following year, so he was not available to testify at the first trial. And that's exactly why he didn't come forward for the second trial, I don't know. But what prompted him apparently was this court's decision in 2005 to contact the state. He was interviewed by a state police detective in June of 2007. And that tape statement was turned over to the defense, and then he was actually called to testify very near the end of the trial in January of 2008.
What's the procedural mechanism for getting a reduction in sentence 11 years later?
Well, you obviously have to file a motion. It's certainly an untimely motion.
Yeah, it wouldn't fit within Rule 35.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the trial court would have to be willing to consider it if the state didn't insist upon the time limits and the court was otherwise willing to consider it. I know it has happened before. I don't think there's any basis to challenge it as an illegal sentence under 35B. I think it would have to be a discretionary matter under 35A. I know at times it may be done if someone does something exemplary to assist the state or otherwise does something exemplary that merits a reduction.
There's a statutory basis for that, isn't there? Like prison overcrowding, sort of
catch-all? There is certainly one statute that allows actually the Department of Corrections to certify that someone should be released. But, I mean, I don't think it would be on the basis of overcrowding here, although there's
I just meant that there are escape valves.
Oh, yes.
Prison overcrowding is the one that immediately comes to mind.
Yes, that's certainly one, and I think the others that I'm familiar with are just if someone really does something exemplary that the trial judge can even go back and revisit it, assuming nobody's raising any objections, and defendant certainly isn't, and if the state's going to take no position, then it's really up to the trial judge whether he wants to do something or not.
Do you want to speak to the request for a limiting instruction? Why it was appropriate to deny the request for a limiting instruction?
Well, I think at that point, the trial judge was still operating under the assumption that there was a basis. The trial judge's ruling later on when a similar type of challenge is brought up is that, well, Mr. Schmitz did feel he was responsible because he assisted Banther when Ravers was still moving, and that's why he thought it was appropriate. So I think given that, there wasn't a necessity for any type of further limiting instruction. The evidence was what it was. I mean, admittedly, it's limited as to accomplice liability, but that's what it was. And ultimately, it's going to be up to the jury as a trier of fact to decide what they want to believe or not believe in the particular case, or which witness they want to believe or not believe. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly attempt to answer those. Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you.
If I can respectfully clear up a couple matters I think may have been an error. Mr. Schmitz was available to testify prior to Banther 1. At pages 38 and 39 of the appendix, you have a letter from his counsel with a proffer as to what he would have testified to. February 11th of 1998, Banther 1 was October of 1998. Respectfully, Mr. Williams indicated that Dr. Butts indicated there was a possibility that the axe wounds may have caused death. I'll refer the court to, again, page 122 of the appendix. And based upon your examination of Mr. Ravers, did you reach a conclusion about the cause of death? This question from the state. Answer, yes. Question, what was that? Answer, I conclude he died as a result of the head injuries, the blows to the head that had fractured the skull and caused damage to the underlying brain. You will not find a word anywhere, either argued without basis or a fact indicating that for which anyone could infer that actions at the burn barrel scene hasten death. It's not there. It's just simply not supported in the evidence. The state never argued that. The state never argued accomplice liability at all in argument. They went strictly upon Mr. Schmitz's testimony was the truth. He didn't do this. Banther did it. It fits the evidence like a key to a lock. That was the state's argument. If you accept that, though, and again, the state hasn't addressed this, if you somehow accept that and somehow conclude that the jury could have found that Mr. Ravers died as a result of what occurred at the burn barrel scene, you have a conspiracy, an agreement. And I went through all the facts before, and there's just no way around it. And that is what's expressly prohibited, since Mr. Banther was acquitted of the conspiracy in Banther 1. The risk here that occurred when the state chose to ask for this jury instruction was that Mr. Banther may be convicted, and the jury had a basis and an ability to convict Mr. Banther based on accomplice liability when there was nothing in the evidence. If there was sufficient evidence to find him guilty as a principal for striking the axe blows, which there was, even though we submit that evidence should not have been allowed in, that's the theory, the only theory, which the state argued and which should have been allowed in. And just to address Justice Holland's question, how did this come up? We brought this up to not allow the state to proceed on accomplice liability from point one in this trial. We knew what the evidence was beforehand. And we brought it up at the motion for judgment of acquittal stage, arguing there was no evidence to go ahead and support the state proceeding on accomplice liability. The court allowed the state to proceed on that and gave the instruction not to explain Mr. Schmitz's testimony, but to convict Mr. Banther. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.